Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. Still to come, a story of open minds, how bizarre head injuries have helped lead to a better understanding of the brain. But first, just because you don't have a clue about Bert's big song in Mad Men or which season The Simpsons jumped the shark doesn't mean you can't have an opinion about them. Lots of other uninformed people do. Thanks to modern media and especially the internet, it's never been easier to find information. But then there's never been so much information to find. Trying to stay on top of everything was targeted by the insightful U.S. comedy show, Portlandia.
Did you read that thing in Pace? It was about the National.
Oh, I saw that. Did you see that thing in Dwell about all the mid-century houses?
Yeah. Did you read the New York Times?
Yes.
New York Observer?
Yes.
Washington Post?
Yes.
Wall Street Journal?
Of course I read it.
Did you read that skywriting over the Willamette River?
Yes. Did you read that fortune cookie?
Yes.
From last night?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Yes.
There was
Doug Bear Show?
That thing that got
show?
In the sand on the beach?
Yeah.
Did you read Mad Magazine?
Doug Bell Show?
Like the end of it.
Did you read Family Story?
Hello, Doug?
Sure.
Hello.
Sure.
Hey, you can hear everything okay?
Yes, I can hear everything. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Of course I did. I read it to a friend of mine. Did you read the closing credits of that movie?
Yeah, did you read that book?
Did you read it?
Did you read the Bible?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Well, there we go, Portlandia. Okay, I've seen Portlandia a few times. I don't actually know if it's insightful. The Current's producers told me it was. Last week, the New York Times published an opinion piece called Faking Cultural Literacy, which, for the record, I have read. The writer, Carl Taro Greenfeld, admits to faking knowledge and says it's never been so easy to pretend to know so much without actually knowing anything.
I think we live in an era where it's easier to fake our way through almost any conversation and pretend to have some kind of knowledge or deep knowledge about the subject at hand, because it's so easy to pick up dates, data, and bits and pieces of information from our various social media feeds. And I think in the past, if you wanted to mimic knowledge or pretend to know something that you maybe didn't really know, you at least had to read a book review, if it were a book, or a movie review, or have somehow done some sort of deeper investigation, whereas now it's literally being pushed at us. Information about the popular subjects of the day, about TV shows and books, it's just getting pushed at us all day through our social media feeds.
In fact, he calls them data motes gleaned from ether. Is it true we're becoming a culture of know-it-alls with only a light dusting of real knowledge? We have reached three guests who know much, if not quite all, on this matter. Alexandra Samuel is the vice president of social media at Vision Critical, a customer intelligence software company. She is in Vancouver. Teresa Moritz is a senior lecturer in English literature at Wordsworth College at the University of Toronto. She's with me in our Toronto studio. And Doug Belshaw researches online education. He is also the web literacy lead for the Mozilla Foundation, and he is in Morpeth, England. Hi, everyone. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Alexandra Samuel, let's start with you. How common is this phenomenon of faking cultural literacy?
Well, it's tempting to fake my way through a exact factoid or statistic, but you know, I think we've all, as Carl pointed out in his opening, you know, people have been faking forever, right? I mean, since the first manuscript was published, we probably had the first Coles notes about 20 minutes later. So I don't think that the phenomenon is a new one, but certainly the range of conversations that we're now expected to take part on, both high and low, is bigger than ever. And so once you've got the combination of that underlying human insecurity about saying I don't know and the emergent phenomenon of needing to know about more things than ever, you're going to have a fair amount of head nodding in the absence of actual contents in that head.
So, Alexandra, can you tell us a time when you faked cultural literacy and the pressure you might have felt?
Well, you know, in my case, it's kind of embarrassing because we live in a culture where there's a lot of musical references and people love to, you know, refer to the music of their youth or not so youth. And I have a problem that basically I can't catch any musical reference that isn't a reference to a show tune. And I will confess that I'm not always willing to admit that my musical knowledge extends only as far north as, you know, Broadway and 49th. So I have been known to nod my head knowingly at Jay-Z references and of course also to get caught out.
And so why do you feel that pressure?
It's a good question. You know, I think it's, you know, we have as a species, a really strong need to create sort of social bonds to people who we want to be like. And this was actually a subject of a lot of my dissertation research, was the way that people try and identify with a group they see as positive and then reinforce those qualities of their own that connect them to that group. And, you know, I think in the case of music literacy, for example, music in our culture is, you know, so identified with coolness and hipness. And in fact, we so often use common cultural reference points to bond ourselves to the group that I think, you know, I like, you know, most people will have moments where I want to sort of strengthen my sense of affiliation and connection with the people I'm working with, the people I'm hanging out. And if they're all, you know, super cool hipsters who listen to, you know, hip hop or alternative or whatever and fail to appreciate the joy and beauty in a Rodgers and Hammerstein lyric, you know, I got to go with the flow.
I have to admit to you that I feel so busted as you talk. Doug Balshaw, how worried are you by the idea that people fake knowledge in order to compete?
Yeah, I think like Alexandra, I don't think this is anything new. I think it happens all the time. And I'm guessing that quite a few of my Canadian colleagues will know that, you know, when we're on calls, when we're on things, we often say that we've seen stuff, but we're actually reading it at the same time as trying to have a conversation. And you can tell when that happens. And it's kind of one of those things you need to get better at as you, you know, you increase your web literacy. But I think really it's one of those situations where in the past, where we had elected representatives or gatekeepers of knowledge, now it's kind of everything's on us. Everything's on us to kind of know about all of these things. Whereas previously we'd give that knowledge, that the idea of keeping up with stuff, to somebody else to sort out. We want to kind of keep that for ourselves, and so we have to kind of fake it. Otherwise, you know, we'd be shown as unknowledgeable in some way.
But do you worry it could be leading to a society that doesn't really know much of anything at all?
Oh, yes, I worry about these things all the time, especially to do with things like privacy and security on the internet, that kind of stuff. And I think sometimes we do focus on the wrong things, and there is a surface-level knowledge and a sheen and a polish that we take for depth and deep knowledge. So I think it's interesting that if you look at the top most visited news sites on the web, they're things like BuzzFeed and The Mail Online, which is a UK newspaper. And they have very long headlines, which I think is indicative of the fact that people take reading the headlines and then the conclusion maybe as being like enough to be able to understand that particular bit of knowledge. So I think there's potentially going to be pushback on that. There's already parodies of things like Upworthy and BuzzFeed. I've got an extension installed called Downworthy, which replaces all of the headlines which are Upworthy kind of BuzzFeed headlines with much more downbeat kind of things.
As the two of you have been speaking, Teresa Moritz, who's sitting in the studio with me, is nodding and smiling. And Teresa, you have studied how your students find information and do research. How is their understanding of what knowing means evolving in the internet age?
I think that probably the most striking thing I have found this year is that students can accept that the material that they are collecting is flawed, has errors in it, but that you don't worry about it because they're sure they can spot the error. So they are confident that their information gathering ability has been honed by experience, and that their protection as to collecting material is their ability to spot something which they have to be careful about. So I think it has changed, because the whole concept of authority, this is what Doug just referred to in terms of the gateways, the gatekeepers of knowledge, that they are looking at a different a system for gathering knowledge. Yes, so I think it has changed.
And when they say they can spot the error, where are they getting the information so they know how to correct it?
Well, I think that's a good question. Worked with students this year comparing Wikipedia entries and scholarly articles and also other encyclopedia articles to Wikipedia entries. I found that often they showed no sign that they had spotted an error. And then I've got this, but we're not concerned about it after all. So their first defense is gone, right? Mm. Okay. But then we're not concerned about it after all. It will be fixed. So it will, you know, we can be sure that the service will eventually be right. So in terms of how they check, I think they check in the way that Doug's description implies. They check across the web. So the web does not necessarily direct them toward the idea that there are sources that might be more reliable.
And I mean, it's interesting that we're talking to someone who teaches English literature and mm-hmm. we're talking about cultural literacy. And I mean, how much does the shorthand affect what you're trying to teach?
Mm. Well, obviously it's been a question for some time. We can say, we just heard from Alexandra that they made a Cliff's Notes or a Cole's Notes as soon as they made a manuscript. As a medievalist, I doubt that because they're so hard to make. And so, but maybe as soon as printing came in, for sure. yes, but how important is it? It seems to me that it is important, but perhaps it's been important in the same way for not just back to the Middle Ages, but since Milton, famously the last person who was able to have read all of knowledge available to him. He knew the languages of the books on his shelves. He read all of them. Since then, we've been running catch-up.
Okay, well, before we go any further, I want to hear from E.D. Hirsch, Jr. In the 1980s, he coined the phrase cultural literacy in a book called Cultural Literacy, What Every American Should Know. And lest I be accused of faking it, I have not read his book. This is how he defines cultural literacy.
Plain old literacy is the ability to decode the words on the page. And you can have that kind of plain old literacy without being able to read a newspaper or a serious book or article. Cultural literacy is a part of what I would call real literacy or true literacy, mature literacy. That is the ability to understand serious materials that you need to be a citizen or even to rise in the economy. We all need to be culturally literate because we all need to be literate. You see, another way of describing cultural literacy is to say it's that knowledge that people take for granted when they write for a magazine or a newspaper.
Well, E.D. Hirsch Jr. goes on to list several thousand pieces of information he thought every American ought to know in order to be culturally literate. Teresa Moritz, why does it matter if our collective knowledge is being fractured, if we no longer have a common base of understanding?
Well, as he suggests, it would be like saying we have no common language, which of course we don't, right? But we live a great deal in our native language or in the language of the society that we are operating in. If we don't have those references, according to Hirsch and according to his knowledge of how we read, if we don't have that internally, actually, we are prevented from performing the action of advanced reading. So it would have a tremendous effect on our ability to participate in culture.
Alexandra Samuel, the idea of an officially sanctioned canon of great works has come under a lot of fire for skewing heavily in favor of dead white privileged men of European descent. How cautious should we be about re-embracing the canon?
Well, I think that what we're seeing in terms of the challenge of keeping up with social media and online news is almost an inversion of that scenario. So on the upside, the canon, as it were, isn't what it used to be. I mean, certainly there's still much to be said, I think, for being literate in the kind of core works and ideas of our culture. You know, just as Teresa said, so you can participate in those conversations, so you can understand what you're reading. But for all the reasons that there were critics of Hirsch's and of the idea of the canon, namely it being a relatively exclusive club, we can be happy that what's happened in the explosion of online content is that, you know, the next thing you have to be literate in could come from anywhere. It could be a hot video that has just emerged from some, you know, street kid in the U.S. It could be a book that was published in Nigeria. It could be a movie that came from France. I mean, really, it's hard to know on a given morning when you wake up and see what's going on Twitter, what part of the world the conversation is being driven by. And you're as likely to get trapped in an office cooler conversation about the, you know, Jay-Z Solange elevator crisis as you are to be expected to have a conversation about you know, the NSA revelations.
Well, funny you should say that, because we have another clip of Carl Taro Greenfield, who wrote that New York Times opinion piece, and he shares your view. Here he is.
I think what's happened now, because the conversation has shifted into this digital realm where all this information is just kind of swirling around, something like the Jay-Z and Beyonce and Solange video becomes an easier reference point for all of us than what used to be the great reference point, than Catcher in the Rye or The Great Gatsby or something. You know, I think more people last week, at least in the United States, were prepared to talk about that cat that attacked the dog that was attacking the kid. More people were ready to talk about that video last week than could possibly refer to the Gettysburg Address. You know, when you have a YouTube video that's picking up 150 or 200 million views in a couple days, that becomes the cultural canon de facto. That becomes our common reference point.
Doug Belshaw, I want you to comment on that. I just want to say I didn't see any of those videos, and I cannot quote the Gettysburg Address. But go ahead.
So what do you think? I think that, so first of all, we've been talking about literacy as reading and writing, but it's more than that. It's kind of being involved in a community of literate people. There's kind of socio-cultural practices around that. But really, it's a way of understanding the world. And so we understand the world through media. So I can remember growing up, the five channels, did you see what was on television last night? Well, you had a 1 out of 5 chance of seeing the same thing. Whereas now there's so much media that we try and understand our lives through these really disparate media, which actually aren't neutral, and they kind of have these built-in problematic biases as well. So when I think it was Alexandra who said that, you know, you wake up in the morning and you don't know where in the world the latest kind of meme or the latest thing is going to come from, that is not a completely emergent grassroots practice. You know, some things do come up like that, but increasingly things are dictated by traditional news media. Things are seeded, things are kind of put our way by people who are experts in viral videos and that kind of thing. So I think it is a way of understanding the world, but I think we need to make sure that we're not naive about the, you know, the structured interest behind the technology that we use.
Teresa Moritz, is there a difference to be drawn between what it means to know something and what it means to understand something and how it affects the world?
Oh, yes, I think so. And I think that that distinction that you're proposing is certainly relevant to this conversation. We've gone back and forth between the question of whether we're aiming to have the appearance of knowledge or actual knowledge, for example. When Doug talks about, of course, we fake. We don't know, and so we think it would be best to fake. And I talked about my students thinking they might be able to spot someone faking. So yes, there's a obvious difference, right? Well, I guess I'm adding a difference, not knowing at all and pretending to know. But there's also a difference between knowing and understanding. Hirsch's idea that he explained in the quotation that you presented, material from him, suggests that there is, in fact, stuff beyond the words on the page or the images on the screen that we bring to the process of looking at them and thinking about them. And I would go farther, I guess this is sort of my own bent here, but I would go farther to say if we believe in the development of experts, then we believe in the difference between entering a field of knowledge and actually being an expert in it. And it's interesting that we've moved in Doug's comments from the idea there are no more gateways, there are no more gatekeepers, but now suddenly there are gatekeepers because we aren't left floating in the horrible mass of things presented to us. Someone is actually preparing us for it. That would be one of the ways that understanding knowledge is key.
Alexander, what do you think?
Well, it strikes me that part of what's driving this phenomenon is that we're no longer required just to be holders of knowledge and to be able to talk about a variety of topics. There's now this idea that everyone is supposed to be an expert in some specific domain. And you see this emergence, and a lot of it does come from social media, this idea that everybody should have a personal brand, which is really a domain of expertise that you're supposed to be demonstrating in a kind of performative way on a daily basis by, you know, posting something to your LinkedIn profile and making sure you're commenting on the most important 5 blog posts in your field that day and tweeting 25 links a day. And in all honesty, and I have written a lot about how you can streamline your workflow so you could do that and put your expertise out there. And yet the truth of the matter is it's pretty hard to navigate that kind of velocity without compromising something in the way of authenticity. And I think we've seen a lot of people tweeting out, Facebooking and so on, sharing content which they themselves haven't fully read. But it's as if the sharing of it is a claim to know something, and it's a way of establishing your expertise.
Didn't you call that FOMO, fear of missing out?
Well, I think FOMO is a bit of a byproduct from that. So when everybody's tweeting 25 links a day and posting about this event and that event, you get this illusion that people are a heck of a lot busier and doing all sorts of cool things while you're sitting at home watching reruns of Mad Men.
Doug Belshaw, how much of this would just go away if we gave ourselves permission to say we didn't see it, we don't know?
I think that is a thing that we need to do. You know, we need to say that, you know, I'm sharing this thing, but I'm looking forward to reading it, which is usually my way of indicating that I haven't read it yet. I think something which is potentially worth teaching to our children, either as parents or educators, is, you know, reviewing things, going back to review things later on, especially given the way that we kind of are immersed in a stream of content on a daily basis. it's quite appropriate that I can't remember the quotation here exactly, but it's something along
but
the
it's
line.
Good of you to admit that, though.
It's something along the lines of, you know, the amount of information we come across in a day these days was about what someone would come across in about a year, 200 years ago. So it's no wonder that our minds are constantly racing with the amount of information possible. But I think kind of reviewing stuff, I send out a weekly newsletter, for example, where I review the stuff that I've shared this week. That kind of thing allows you to step back and reflect and review what you've shared.
Teresa Moritz, what do you think?
I think that the notion of reviewing that that Doug suggests there is a very strong one. In one of the comments on Greenfeld's article, someone says, I got through school the way you did, Greenfeld, because of the story about the notes that enabled him to get a B on his paper on the book he hadn't read. But now I'm going back and reading them.
Well, there you go. There's a lesson for your students there, too, maybe. Thank you. We have to leave it there. Thanks, everyone, for weighing in on this one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Alexandra Samuel. She's the Vice President of Social Media at Vision Critical in Vancouver. Teresa Moritz is a senior lecturer in English literature at Woodsworth College at the University of Toronto. Doug Belshaw researches online education for the Mozilla Foundation. He was in Moorpath.